we make the assessment that our ally could hold out, right, for much longer, and got it completely wrong. And we did just the opposite in Kyiv, right? We said, oh no, this is going to be over in days. We should not send weapons because they'll soon be in Russian hands. At least the U.S. intelligence community is looking hard at what led to those two intelligence failures.
Robert Cardillo is one of the most senior and respected former intelligence officials in Washington. From 2006 to 2010, he served as Deputy Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, later becoming the Acting Director for Intelligence to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the first time a civilian had been appointed to that role. In 2010, he was appointed to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, where, among other things, he was responsible for delivering the President's daily intelligence briefing. Robert finished his public service career as Director of the US National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Robert joined us to talk about China, the Middle East, and what it was like in the Situation Room on the night Osama bin Laden was shot. Robert, you began your career as a humble analyst, I think, in 1983, and you finished it with the lofty title of Director for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and before that you wore many, many hats as a senior intelligence practitioner. Tell us a little bit about what got you into the trade and in particular what kept you in it for so long.
I'm happy to, Paul. The short answer to your question is mostly luck. You can imagine when one was looking to join the intelligence service in the early 1980s, there wasn't a whole lot of public material to go on. And so I rather blindly put in a number of applications as I came out of college, one up at Langley at CIA, and one to the Defense Intelligence Agency. And I must admit, part of my luck was I was applying during the first term of Ronald Reagan. He was rebuilding defense, which is what he ran on for president. When the defense budget rises, the intelligence budget rises. And so again, I had a bit of timing on my side as my application hit, someone's desk. And I was offered the position of intelligence research specialist photographic interpreter. And I didn't really know what that was, but I wanted and needed to join. And so I said, okay, this is the door I'm going to enter. And suffice to say, I had just, I loved every part of my career and had many, many wonderful opportunities. But the opportunity to be an analyst, to be assigned an account, was very meaningful to me because, one, it's the craft, and how is it that you apply that craft to gain insight against an adversary from about 200 miles in space? And you can imagine it takes some pieces of the puzzle that you're given, some that you're not given. And by the way, you're never given the box top to know exactly what it is. And I just had a passion. I just loved the pursuit of the unknown and just really, really enjoyed that first decade of my career because every day, every night, I got to try to uncover some sort of enigma, if not a mystery, in a way that could advantage decision makers. And I think that's the essence of intelligence. So I just, I really look back fondly on those first few years.
And what sort of, to the extent that you can talk about it, Robert, what sort of targets did you work in those early days?
It's very easy. So you remember the time period, our president had deemed the Soviet Union the evil empire. I was responsible to better understand the KGB communication units in the Transcaucasus Military District. Again, doesn't sound that exciting, but I loved it because it was my account. I was a young analyst and I needed to learn. And
what did that involve?
Well, like it said, it involved sitting on a light table. So imagine a piece of glass with light emanating from beneath it, a microscope on top of that table, and rolling images underneath the microscope that had been captured from 200 miles in space by a top secret satellite that would take a top secret image that would be downloaded quite oftenly via parachute, which was amazing to me, right? And captured somewhere over the Pacific Ocean flown to Rochester, New York. The negative was turned into a positive. The positives would be driven down to a building in Washington, D.C. I or my colleagues would be waiting at the loading dock for that quote, current imagery that was at least weeks old, if not months old. And that's one thing, we might want to talk about, Paul, is what a difference there is now, right? Because if you wanted to remotely sense our planet in the early 1980s, you needed to be a big government with a big intelligence community with a big budget. And then you would put a lot of compartments and classifications around it because it was an advantage. If you can see something that your adversary can't, you have an advantage. And so that was, almost my first 2 decades. Really, commercial imagery didn't really begin to be introduced until around the turn of the century. So my first 20 years were almost a wholly owned government, owned and controlled enterprise.
There must be security implications for the fact that what was once a niche, high-end capability available only to the wealthier countries, the US and the Soviets, at that time, has now been extended to everybody. Non-state actors, terrorist groups would be using this kind of imagery. Smaller states, the North Koreans, so forth. What are the implications of the fact that that capability has now been extended far and wide?
My shorthand answer is something that I used to tell the US militaries when I was director of NGA, is that because you can imagine that they would have some concern with all of this commercial capability, exposing, uncovering, sharing inappropriately with adversaries their movements, their capabilities. And my shorthand to them was that you need to find a way to succeed in the open, meaning the world is becoming more transparent. And by the way, imagery didn't lead that transparency. It's by these mobile devices that most of us carry around all the time that there's a connectedness to the world and there's a transparency to the world that didn't exist. So if your adversary is going to be roughly on the same level of as you with respect to access to commercial imagery or imagery from a remote position, you have to have a different way to create advantage. That advantage, you could create advantage through time. You could act sooner. That advantage could be through analytics. And by that, I mean, it's one thing if you and I have the same image. It's quite another thing if my algorithm can extract the information from that image either better and or faster. And by the way, I do think that's the coin of the realm these days. And by the way, I have business connections to satellite imaging companies. And yes, one always needs the fuel. Obviously, you need to have that raw data. The real value these days is heading to the other end. It's to the output side. And so that's where I think the race is now. And that's where I think we have to get better if we want to sustain our advantage.
One of the perhaps career highlights is not the right term for it, but one of the most notable episodes in what was a pretty exciting career was when you were Deputy Director of the Office of Director of National Intelligence. And you were in the Situation Room on the night that the Navy SEALs hit the compound in Abbottabad and killed Osama bin Laden. And I understand in that famous press shot of the President and Secretary Clinton looking at the screen and watching the operation, you were in the room just out of shot. Tell us about what it was like in the room that night.
When I found out that that the connection forward to Abbottabad was going to be in the smallest of rooms in the Situation Conference Center, I saw 7 chairs in the room. Two were already occupied because the general was in his seat, and there was a warrant officer who was in charge of the communications connection. And I said, okay, I am not the fifth-ranking person wandering around here today. I'm getting a chair before it's too late. And I actually, and by the way, when I first went into the room, the helicopters were airborne. They had left Afghanistan, but it was a 90-minute flight, right? And we all knew it was a 90-minute flight, and there wasn't going to be much update, obviously, for 88 minutes, right? They were going to make their transit. I kid you not, Vice President Biden came by the door and he says, "Hey, Robert, what's going on in here?" And I said, "Mr. Vice President, this is where we'll learn first, right? This is where the info will come in first." So he says, "Okay, move over." So I did. I moved over one seat, but to your point, that move cropped me out of history, right? So I was just to his right. But back to your point, what was it like? As is well known and has been well documented, right? The first helicopter landed safely and their job was perimeter security, and that went fine. Second helicopter was the attack force, right? That was the force that was going to fast rope into his balcony. Now, by the way, I say his balcony. We still didn't know he was there. It was an intelligence assessment, right? So that helicopter obviously had a what they call an anomaly, right? And so it basically crashed in the compound, but not in the ha where the house was. It was kind of like a second compound to the next. You knew immediately that there was a helicopter down. And remember at the moment, if I can take you back, because what do we know at that time? We don't know the bin Laden's in the compound. We actually don't know if any SEALs have been hurt or killed in the crash. I mean, helicopters, are dangerous things, and when you don't land them right, bad things can happen. If you think of American history here and military operations involving helicopters, it's not wonderful, right? Meaning Desert One, which is where we attempted to rescue our hostages in Tehran, and had a very tragic accident in the desert. And Black Hawk Down, right, in Somalia, right? So I will tell you that I felt like you could hear heartbeats in the room at that time because you just didn't know. And I think the record will actually be that it took maybe 20 seconds before we heard from Admiral McRaven, who was running the mission from Afghanistan, and he said something to the effect, "We will now amend the mission." And as soon as I heard him say that, I felt a lot better because, okay, he's in charge. They've done this before. They know what they're doing. So, obviously, the operation continued. The SEALs gained entrance a different way into the compound, into the house, up to the third floor, where they did find bin Laden and engaged. I will tell you, though, that the next thing that happened, I mean, obviously, they're on the ground for some number of minutes. They're detaining the civilians, they're collecting media. To take with them. But they also had a very sensitive helicopter that was sitting on the ground there that they couldn't exfil with, right? They couldn't leave with. So they did the best they could to blow it up, right? Well, it's 1:30 now in the morning in Abbottabad, which and that was a very large explosion. So anybody who didn't know something was going on, that explosion told everyone something was going on. And while the team and the body of, again, we couldn't positively identify bin Laden on the site, that came later. But as they egressed, remember, they had a 90-minute flight back. Now, not all of that was over Pakistan, but you now have a reasonable military that's reacting to a violation of their airspace, and somebody did an operation. And so I will tell you, I didn't fully exhale until we heard the call. We're back in Afghan airspace.
And what about President Obama and Secretary Clinton and Vice President Biden? How did they respond to these events, in particular the president? What sort of directions or observations did he make as, the helicopter went down and as, the mission had to be amended? What was his attitude towards it all?
Again, the room was really quiet. There wasn't chatter, right? Everybody was just trying to digest and understand. And I just want to reemphasize, there was nothing, there were no commands coming out of the White House. Okay, that was, he had made his decision back on Thursday. He had given the authority. It actually went through CIA, the way it worked at the time. So it went to, Mr. Panetta, and then it went out to Admiral McRaven. Once we all got word that they had cleared the airspace, he did get up, and I know he shook the hand of the general at the top of the table and the warrant officer and thanked some people. But again, we still didn't know for sure. We had what the SEALs believed to be a positive identification, but that can be wrong. And so The original plan was we have to have DNA evidence before the president announces the mission. Turns out that was going to take about 24 hours. And the story was beginning to leak before then. And the president made a call to go to the cameras. You know, maybe that was 12 hours in, you know, from the mission itself. And that was done mainly through photographic identification. They now had photos. And, you know, there are specialists who do that, you know, earlobe, you know, facial features, et cetera. It wasn't as positive as you would get with DNA, but it was enough for the president to go to the press and to the world.
To what extent, I mean, you're an intelligence analyst by trade. To what extent going into the mission were you confident that Osama, or not confident, that Osama bin Laden was in the compound and that it was not some other high-value target? What did you think the odds of success were?
I don't think it was the president, but in one of the meetings, people said, "Well, what percentage do you believe? You know, how much confidence do you have? Is it 50%? Is it 70?" And a few people started to answer that question, and Bob Gates, who had obviously run CIA, but now was at the Pentagon, and arguably one of the most celebrated analysts in the history of the U.S. intelligence community, stopped the exercise. He said, "This is silly, right? You can't put a number on this, right? It's a judgment, right? Now you can say which pieces of evidence do you put strong credence into? What do you think is the best case?" And it wasn't Bob, but somebody else in the room said, "I don't know what number to put on, you know, this possibility, but it is 10 times better than any case we've had to date.
And
This
did
is by far by far the best case."
you agree with that assessment? I mean, you had seen, I
No,
assume,
I
all of the
did.
raw intelligence.
Yeah, I did. And the one thing that I will tell you what troubled me, though, is there were, and I might get the numbers wrong, but I think there were a couple of dozen people that lived on that compound, to include kids and wives and relatives. And as far as we knew, kids went to school, right? And, you know, people, I mean, they obviously didn't have, you know, guests over and whatnot, but, you know, they, and I just said, "That's odd to me. You know, if you were the most wanted human on the planet, would you let people, you know, go in and out?" So I will tell you that troubled me, but I did think it was the best case that we had. And again, this also gave me confidence. I believe the SEALs were so good at doing what they were doing. Let's say they showed up and it was a weapons dealer or a drug dealer or somebody, you know, that we would get in and we would get out. Okay. Now, there would be explaining to do at some level, but now obviously I didn't project a helicopter crash as part of that, right? Because there was some debate for a while that the SEAL raid was too risky and that we should do a remote strike.
How seriously was that option contemplated?
There were some serious voices in the sit room that advocated for that, very senior people, and I think the reason they did was they were so worried about the raid breaking the relationship with Pakistan and the carryover effect. Even if you quote get bin Laden, right, we would have a broken relationship with a country that we needed in order to be successful in Afghanistan. The huge obvious downside to remote is you never know, right? You never know, quite frankly, that you succeeded or not. And obviously, the president decided to go with the SEAL option.
What made the president's decision to go with a SEAL strike rather than a remote strike?
He keeps his cards extremely close. Having said that, my interpretation is that it was his confidence in Admiral McRaven and the SEALs. Obviously, he had to believe credibly in the case that he too believed it was the best assessment that we had as far as his location.
Just moving on from that, one of your jobs was, I think, editing and then delivering the president's daily intelligence brief. Talk to us a little bit about that. What does that involve? How long does that brief last for? Kind of criteria do you set for yourself in determining what goes in the brief and what
So everything is tailored to the president, of course, and whoever the president is. And so this was a very specific application that worked for President Obama. I would get the drafts that were projected to go into the brief the next day around 6 p.m. the night before. I would get four, five, six would be a lot drafts of, you can imagine, and I'll go more into this, but an Iranian update, a North Korean update, China, Russia, Africa, I mean anything. I would, and part of my editing was to answer your question because we had two overriding questions that we had to answer first. The first one is, why does the president need to know this? A lot of things could fall into that category because of our global interest and responsibilities. The second question, though, was more winnowing, and that was, why does the president need to know this now? Meaning, yeah, okay, he might need to know everything, but he's a busy person, he's got a schedule, he's got a set of visits and meetings and decisions. And so that second question was the one that really was harder to get over. And obviously it was driven again by key decisions he was making with respect to deployments or upcoming meetings or negotiations he or his team might be having. By the way, the other thing is the president isn't the only one to get the PDB. Under President Obama, it was probably a couple of dozen senior in his cabinet, you could imagine secretaries of defense and treasury, et cetera, that would need to know what he was reading and the analysis he was getting. But it was, even though that sounds like a lot of people in Washington, that's a very small group. I would, at least in my case, if I was briefing the next morning, I usually had to leave my house around 5 in the morning, just because even though he generally got his sit down brief at 9:30, there was a lot of things to do before you went into that Oval Office. He likes to read things ahead of time. So it would go to his residence around 6 or 6:30 in the morning. He would read it there. So by the time I saw him at 9:30, he had read it. Now, if he had questions, he could bring them there, but I didn't have to brief the book to him because he had already read it. That's the way he works best. And we would develop what we called a walk-on brief, which would basically be connective tissue. Mr. President, this morning we updated you on our assessment of, North Korean capabilities in a certain regard. You'll recall that's a change, from what we told you in the summer. The reason is we've got an access or an approach that has improved. And by the way, we hope to even make this better, or more informed. And so it would be that kind of conversation with him. Most of the time, it was just me or Director Clapper. There were times when the subject was so complex that we would bring in an expert, and they would do 7, 8, 9 minute ex. We called them expert briefs. But I always told them, I said, by the way, he will not interrupt you unless he's completely confused about something. But he will want to hear your whole case. But when you're done and you say thank you for your time, Mr. President, be ready because he's going to ask you the question you least want to get, because he'll find the biggest weakness in your analytic methodology, or he'll ask you a strategic question about a very tactical situation about, okay, where does this put us in 3 years? He was amazing that way. He never seemed to disappoint to either find that weak spot and or put that kind of tactical intelligence in a very strategic frame.
Look, we're talking in January 2024, and the year begins with the world facing an array of very serious security challenges. We've got the war in Ukraine, we've got the Middle East conflict escalating, and we've got renewed tensions in North Korea. If you were briefing the president today, what advice would you give him or her about what to expect over the next 12 months?
Suffice to say, North Korea is always, sits at a very high tier of interest, of course, given that country's positioning and development of weapons. They have moved, the young leader has moved to a what I find to be a worrisome, provocative state. I would probably, as much as attention as rightly is being placed on, Russia and Ukraine, And obviously the ongoing operations in and around Gaza, and now echoing out from that, I think I would lead with North Korea for two reasons. One, just sheer unpredictableness of him, and kind of the immediate potential for, crisis. I was just in Seoul this fall and was reminded, one, of the vibrancy of that capital, right, and their economy, ingenuity. But at least as I was walking those streets, I also knew I was within artillery range
And for
of a bad decision. And I just worry greatly about that these days.
context, we should say that we're having this discussion at a time when the North's rhetoric towards South Korea has changed markedly, and there is a debate about what that means. North Korea has labelled South Korea the principal enemy. Kim Jong-un has abolished agencies devoted to reunification. He's threatening to change the North's constitution to include the occupation and subjugation of South Korea. And some very senior analysts and former State Department officials are saying that this is not just the usual escalation in rhetoric that we see from North Korea, often in the lead up to US presidential election season. This is, in fact, a change in strategy and that the North is preparing for war. So that's the context in which we're having this discussion. What is your view on that debate and what's going on in North Korea at the moment?
I agree with those who believe that this is, fundamentally different. This isn't just the cycle of escalation and de-escalation. It is different. I would add, and I presume others have commented, that there is and there has been a fundamental change to include in the Constitution in Tokyo, which I think Kim Jong-un is taking quite seriously. The Japanese Self-Defense Force has, in fact, or is has in fact committed to create, what they call, counter-offensive, and that will increase their weaponry, that'll increase their ranges, and again, Kim Jong-un's, primary focus is Seoul and is us. But I think he's probably also reacting to the reality of what he sees as a more provocative region. And so I guess the most positive way to interpret, the changes is that he believes I didn't change the calculus here, or the regional balance, Tokyo did, Seoul did. I have to react to that, or I will show weakness, and the last thing I can do is show weakness. I don't have any, obviously particular insight into the. I tend to stay in the camp that he is not suicidal. And that he will go to these edges, and I now, and again, I'll finish that thought. I do not believe he will purposefully provoke a conflict. What I worry about, though, is that the posturing and the maneuvering and the positioning will get us so close that an accident will tip us over. And look, we've had flare-ups on the border in the region, and that's what I worry about. That will trip us into a cascading crisis that will then result in kind of horrifying results.
Do you think that North Korea's rhetoric is, or its activities are in part due to, or a function, if you like, of the war in Ukraine and the Middle East and the fact that the world's attention is focused on those conflicts, and that there is a window of opportunity for this sort of thing? Is that a plausible proposition?
I was struck by the moment when the Pentagon announced that they were placing a second carrier air group in the Eastern Med. And this was in reaction to the events of 7 October and the response and the concern that the war in Gaza was going to cascade. I did, by the way, my first thought wasn't Kim Jong-un, it was President Xi. Meaning, what an interesting time to provoke a Taiwanese crisis. The US is not, and obviously we need to be able to, we the US need to be able to do more than one thing at a time, but two carrier groups in the Eastern Med is a pretty big commitment for us. And now, I mean, it was rather a glib thought that I had quickly, but I think it does inform Kim's thinking with respect to, I have more room perhaps now.
And you obviously think the same about President Xi in China. Just expand on that a little bit. I mean, what are the risks there as these two conflicts in the Middle East and in Europe unfold? What are the potential risks in the Asia Pacific? What are the probabilities, I suppose, that an actor like President Xi or Kim Jong-un will exploit that distraction?
As in a kinetic move
Not
versus
necessarily.
so any, maybe an economic blockade or embargo or something. I actually net out that I do not believe President Xi will make that step. Like I said, I'm well aware of his direction to his military with respect to the capacity and the capability some 3 years hence now. But I believe strongly, especially on Taiwan, we can come back to North Korea, but on Taiwan, I think we're fast approaching, if not in what I would call mutual economic destruction, meaning there is so much value that both, well, not the global economy is so intricately dependent on the chip manufacturing that occurs on that island, that even a short interruption, I think, would create a shock that would make the pandemic look mild. And so I believe that will keep China, President Xi, from creating such a crisis. Does that mean to think that lower level provocations won't exist? No, of course not. I mean, as I read it and understand it, the recent elections in Taipei, did not come out the way that Beijing would have preferred. Yes, there was some increase in rhetoric. I also understand there was some increase in, violations in airspace and crossing of lines. But I didn't sense a dramatic reaction. Now, one could explain that is you don't want to, play the card, when it's most expected. You want to play the card when it's most effective. And perhaps now is not that time. But anyway, a long way to say is I still remain, I think there is a stability, and I think it's broadly economic.
Turning to some of these other flashpoints, the war in Ukraine continues its sad and bloody and depressing progression. Where do you think that will go over the course of the year? Do you think that the balance has now tipped towards Moscow and Moscow has the strategic advantage? And what do you think the implications of that are?
I do think I say broadly tipped to Moscow's advantage. The war is broadly static, and again, that term is offensive to forces engaged on those front lines, because I'm sure it's horrendous. But the ability for either side to make meaningful changes, in the forward line is almost gone. And I do appreciate there is a risk of, call it Western or US impatience or lack of interest or lack of commitment that could affect, obviously, and would affect, obviously, Ukraine's ability to sustain those lines. But the advantage is so now held by the defender on either side that I believe we're roughly at the end. So what I unfortunately believe is that This goes to some settlement. Some settlement that ends up with, you know, Ukraine being less than it was in February of 22. But let's remember that Ukraine was less in 2014, you know, with the move in Crimea. So I just unfortunately think this is going to play out, you know, I guess roughly to Putin's advantage, but, you know, let's remember what Putin's objective was literally 2 years ago as we speak, right? It was in fact to roll the country. And and I don't have any insight here. He either had bad intelligence or he didn't believe those that were advising against the move to the capital. But I think he still nets out with more territory.
I mean, it's a digression, but speaking of bad intelligence, I think we can say, you might have a different view, but there was an intelligence failure on the part of the West too in its assessment of the Russian war machine.
I will see your failure and raise it, because I believe, remember, that followed not far on the heels of our failure in Afghanistan. We made the assessment that our ally could hold out, right, for much longer, and got it completely wrong. And we did just the opposite in Kyiv, right? We said, oh no, this is going to be over in days. We should not send weapons because they'll soon be in Russian hands. At least the U.S. intelligence community is looking hard at what led to those two intelligence failures.
What about the Middle East and the conflict, the escalating conflict or the widening conflict is probably a better way of putting it, that we are seeing in the Middle East? We're now seeing these, obviously we have the conflict in Gaza, but we're also seeing proxy conflicts in southern Lebanon and Houthi attacks in the Gulf. What do you make of that? How worried should we be that this will become a region-wide conflict?
I'm going to land in the same place I do kind of in my Korean assessment, in that I do not believe any of the actors that matter, so that's Tel Aviv, Beirut / Hezbollah, Tehran, actually want or desire to have a broader regional conflict. I don't believe any of them do. However, the risk is even greater here of a cascading accident. And by the way, even if that were somehow to occur, I still believe it's in interests of those controlling authorities to even limit that. And so while as bad as it is, I am somewhat hopeful that as horrifying as everything has been, I mean, look, horrifying history, right? Horrifying reality of that region. But since the 7th of October to today, is that perhaps that horror could lead to more meaningful substantive movement to, you know, a two-state solution? And I appreciate that, you know, offends some people and shocks other people. You know, you can argue that what Hamas was seeking to do was to create such an overreaction, or a reaction, let's just call it a reaction for now, that it would do two things. One, that it would eliminate what people thought was coming, which was a Saudi rapprochement with Tel Aviv. Certainly has suspended that. I don't know if it's ended that, but it certainly suspended that. And two, that because they expected Israel to, you know, react in a way that they were somewhat playing out, is that it would create a counterweight for the Palestinian cause. But I do remain somewhat hopeful that can be possible on the other side, a two-state solution.
Well, I mean, if you were to ask the Israelis about all this at the moment, I think they would say that, in a sense, there is nothing surprising here, that the golden thread that connects all of these conflicts is Iran, and that this is what Iranian hegemony in the Middle East looks like, and we should all get used to it because we're going to see a lot more of it. To what extent was this kind of activity, this role we now see Iran playing in facilitating these conflicts, foreseen by the US intelligence community say 10 to 15 years ago.
Again, it's quite clear that, I mean, analytically, you know, what I know from my career, what you said is exactly right. I'm gonna move to more of a policy perspective now, which is not something I did during my career. And I actually believe that, you know, obviously JCPOA, the agreement with the Iranians to regulate and reduce their movement towards a nuclear weapon in exchange for some recognition and some economic benefits. I thought that was the right general thing to do. And the reason is I believe Iran, if engaged, and if we engage, that there could be a different Iran, that there could be a different outcome. You know, I'm well aware that, you know, the U.S. has a lot of history, and not all of it good, a lot of it bad, with respect to, you know, hearts and minds and et cetera. But my view of that population, their education, their what I would call their and I fully understand the theocracy that runs the country, what I would call kind of a liberal undercurrent that I thought was worth trying to tap. We've since made a different decision, right, with respect to that outreach. I think we're obviously further away from any sort of engagement, but I just have to believe that there is a way that Iran isn't the antagonist and isn't the center of, you know, the undermining of the outreach. And look, I have no idea if and when we can get back to bringing, you know, a Saudi Arabia into the conversation with Tel Aviv. But I have to imagine that the mullahs in Tehran worry about that greatly. And so I'm actually, well, look, I think it would be good on a number of levels, but because it would be viewed poorly by those religious leaders, that makes me even more interested in pursuing that path.
We've got a U.S. presidential election bearing down on us very quickly. It looks all but certain that Trump will be the nominee, and it will be a rematch, a Biden v. Trump rematch. What sort of implications does that have for some of these conflicts? Will we see a different approach, particularly in places like Ukraine, if we see a re-elected Donald Trump?
I think the big worry, and by the way, I think this worry would exist just at different levels, no matter who would come through in the recompete, is in confidence in U.S. commitments. And what I mean by that is that, okay, let's take aside Trump Biden for a minute, and just take the experience of the U.S. from 9/11, right, through the withdrawal in Kabul. It would be quite understandable if one were to go, okay, U.S. went way out, got way involved, got way deployed. There's going to be a generation or so of less. And I will, and some of that is U.S., you know, general fatigue. Some of that is the reality of the results of our investments. So I think even taking out Biden and Trump, I think that there would have been a general pullback, right? I won't go as far as isolationist, but just a general pullback. Now add to that, okay, add to that. And by the way, you know, obviously President Trump, you know, during his term, you know, he had kind of both going on, right? You know, oh, let's go talk to North Korea. Why not, right? Let's go have these big summits. Let's go all in Tel Aviv, right? Jerusalem. You know, obviously Russia is a mixed bag with his performance in Finland, especially as someone who was in the intelligence community when he went to the podium and said he believed Putin more than he believed his intelligence community. But I have a lot of friends in the Middle East, and this is pre-October 7th, right, who said, where have you gone? I mean, we get it, right, that there was going to be some sort of general downtrend, but you can't leave completely. Again, I have no connection to the Biden administration. I mean, but as an observer, I don't think that was an accident. I think he and his team said, look, we have other priorities. We're going to reduce our level of commitment in that region. Putin made the decision vis-a-vis, you know, Ukraine that Obviously, something the administration then had to deal with. I thought they did well, and broadly speaking, are doing well. But obviously, most of the initial credit should go to the Ukrainians themselves. But so, if I come back to your question, sure, do I think there will be a difference if Biden's reelected versus Trump is reelected? Of course. I think the broader issue is more concerning to me about kind of, where is America's sense of responsibility or duty or internationally. I think it's still trending downward, no matter who wins. And again, the world has many opinions about the goodness or badness of US role internationally. If it is in fact changing, right, that I think how the world then reacts to that, and obviously there's a lot of individual actors, then becomes more important. So a messy answer to your to a messy world, but I think the general trend towards keep it home, it will continue.
Robert Cardillo, thank you for joining us on Meridian 100.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
That was Robert Cardillo. I'm Paul Maley. Please join us next time on Meridian 100.